This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and for a special series dedicated to conspiracy theories, my guest today is Professor Gonzalo Soltero. Professor Soltero has published the book Conspiracy Narratives South of the Border, Bad Hombres Do the Twist, published by Routledge in 2021. Conspiracy theories have a long history and exist in all modern societies. However, their visibility and significance are increasing today. Conspiracy theories can no longer be simply dismissed as the product of a pathological mindset located on the political margins. In fact, we cannot just make laugh of conspiracy theories. Now, Mexico, which is the object of this study, is a fertile terrain for conspiracy theories due to its complex social environment and its proximity to the United States, which not only made it a strategic platform during the Cold War, but also today's land of bad hombres that, according to Donald Trump, should be fended off with a war. Conspiracy theories are always narrative in nature, telling us about the state of the world and the actors behind such conditions. This narrativity tends to be so enthralling that they have increasingly become the substance of entertainment and, unfortunately, also politics. So this book analyzes Mexican conspiracy narratives and explains how they produce meaning in a variety of social and political contexts. This book will present four conspiracy narratives from Mexico that push the boundaries of conspiracy research into new direction. And amongst these conspiracy narratives, I should mention those that are connected to to Lee Harvey Oswald's visit to Mexico City before the assassination of JFK, but also narratives that have been produced related to street gangs across the borders and how some of our worst fears are projected onto them. But before we delve into all of that, Gonzalo, welcome.
Thank you very much, Roberto. Happy to be here.
So the first question I want to ask is if you can tell us a little bit more about yourself and also about the origins of the book.
Yes, sure. This has a lot to do with my interest in literary texts, in literature in general. I knew from being very young that I wanted to be a writer and write narrative. And I saw that there was this also increasing role of conspiracy theories in a lot of plots in fiction. You could see it sometimes in series, in now you can see it everywhere in streaming platforms, in movies and so on. But I was always interested in what made a good story so good. And this kept me going to writing some stories, but also trying to analyze them, to studying them. And the difference is that instead of studying literary text, I wanted to see some stories that were completely fiction, fictional as it came out later, but at the point, people believed them to be true. And I was very, very intrigued at how they actually could achieve this thing with no matter who the public was, no matter what was their social standing, their education, they could still convince them that this was happening and this was true. So this is where, when I started developing a research line in academia, I started looking at what is the social function of some narratives, and especially these ones, conspiracy theories and also urban legends, struck me very, very strongly, because I was intrigued to knowing, are they real or not, to what extent, when, and so on. So this is what started me on this course.
Conspiracy theories are narratives, and I understand that some scholars may have different views, but I guess we can all agree that, you know, regardless of the length or the medium which they're spread, but they definitely are narratives. And so I was wondering if you can speak a little bit about your approach to conspiracy theories, and also, because you already mentioned urban legends and myths, if you can tell us a little bit more about the difference and also the similarities between myths, urban legends, and conspiracy theories that are part of your work.
Yes, of course. I think that what you mentioned is important, because for psychologists, for example, what will be more important is how people perceive these different narratives. But the main thing for me is that the only way for these conspiracy theories or urban legends to spread is through a story, through a narrative that is exchanged between people. It can be verbally or it can be through social media. So the main thing is, okay, so how do they work? They have this very, very clear and very striking characteristics. They tend to be brief, or they can be easily condensed, whether they're trying to tell the story that they bring. And at the same time, they can be very complex when they are linked to, say, when they spread over the internet, how they lead and link some web pages and some ideas and some platforms and some people. So the main idea is how these stories come to life and how they evolve and how they spread. I do think that the conspiracy theories in general have a lot to do with the specific urban legends that I study, which is not all urban legends. An example I give to make this more or less clear, there is a well-known urban legend that is called the microwave poodle, which is about a lady who goes out for a walk with her dog. It rains, the dog gets wet, and she tries to dry it in the microwave with a very sad ending for the poor dog. This would obviously not be related to conspiracy theories, but the urban legends that I study are crime urban legends that are supposed to be going at the moment that they are these stories are being told. So the main point, what I think it's a very central motive, is what I call them. Both conspiracy theories and these criminal legends have some sort of villains behind the scenes. In the case of urban legends, criminal urban legends, they are a bit more visible. The legends are about these criminal gangs doing some sort of things. And in the case of conspiracy theories, it's usually more behind the scenes. They tend to be more powerful. But it's always narrative about these very evil people that are trying to manipulate society or do something evil to the people that are listening to the stories. And at any moment, this can happen to them.
I want to keep the conversation a little longer on methodology, because I found your book extremely fascinating in terms of like your methodological approach. And I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about the analytical tools that you are employed in your book. And, you know, I want to tell the listeners that there is an entire chapter dedicated to textual analysis, which is great. And also, if you can tell us a little bit more about your methods and the sources that you have used for the book.
Yes, thank you. I have to say that on a lot of aspects, methodology is my bane. It's not something I'm very comfortable about. And this is especially with narratives, which are very elusive. And even I have had problems, because a lot of the methodological tools and approach that I use come from literary theory. And here in Mexico, sometimes fields, academic fields, tend to be very conservative and protective. So at the beginning, I had a lot of resistance saying, but urban legends or conspiracy theories are not literary texts. You cannot do a literary analysis upon them. So, I mean, this has been evolving as we mentioned briefly before recording as a field. Now it's more accepted. But the main thing is using, for example, the work of Paul Ricoeur, who has made a very, very interesting, very complex work about hermeneutics, know how our stories experience, what do they tell us, and following this with also some cultural and psychological analysis, know, for example, from authors like Clifford Geertz. So it's Clifford Geertz. At some point, his whole approach to anthropology was summarized with the idea, he didn't wrote this textually, but it is in his book, The Interpretation of Cultures, about how culture is the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. So what intrigued me was, okay, these kind of stories, these narratives are taking a stronger place in our conversations, in our social sphere. So how can we approach them? And as you mentioned, now with this, one of the strongest analytical tools I get is the idea of paratext that I take from Gerard Genet, who takes all these usually little texts that come before or after a text. For example, in a book, it's very clear. We can speak of the title, whatever appears on the cover, the name of the author himself, the name of the publishing house. If there is a prologue, a dedication, an epigraph, all these, Genet says, are things that try to convince us of reading the book in a certain way. And they will very likely influence our opinion of what we are about to read and have read afterwards. And afterwards, also, like critical works, reviews, and so on, can also influence the text. It's very common, for example, for some books that appear to have some short writings of other authors promoting the book. So these are all paratexts. And some of the texts I study, which are the urban legends, when I came into contact with them, was on a very kind of a first person basis, because they were emails that I received, and they were being sent by colleagues, by friends, by family as actual warnings. So I collected a lot of this. My inbox was very much like this, you know, almost like a Petri's dish where I collected some of these samples. And I started thinking that this idea of Gerard Genet could be applied to them, because it's usually the same thing. You know, it depends a lot on who sends the email, very similar to who is the author of a book. That will depend if you pick it up in the library or if you start reading it and so on. And also the title, you know, what it's the subject in an email, it will condition to a long extent to see if you open it and if you continue reading. And usually what happens is that, again, this comes from what Victor Turner calls a star group, you know, the people that you care more about. So you will open the message. It says, urgent, important, read this. So this is the subject, is like the title, and it gets you reading. And there are also a lot of paratexts that are small forwards saying, I didn't believe this was true until I received it three times. So this also starts getting you into a certain emotional state that will make you more likely to be influenced by the text. And then comes the narrative of the, in this case, the crime legend, which is very short and very eloquent. You see, so there's this all this process there. So I this was very important for the urban legends. And in the case of conspiracy theories, it's interesting because they have been conspiracy theories that started after they are related to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, because the official killer, Lee Harvey Oswald, came to Mexico shortly before. But it's interesting that these conspiracy theories waited some years to start developing. I think that probably at this moment, we're currently at the point where these urban legends are at the strongest, and when they are getting like the most serious coverage by some, you know, some global media outlets, newspapers or journalists that used to work in some of this. So here it was very different because I went to the files. I went to what is like the central, it's called the General Archive of the Nation, no, in Mexico. It's it's very eloquent because it used to be prison. It was a very modern prison that dictator at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, Porfirio Díaz, started as a very important prison following the idea of the Panopticon, which is also interesting. And for a lot of time, the prisoners that were there, they were, finally it was open, it was made into this archive, and now a lot of the files about these prisoners are there, which is some of which I review. This is the case because I am looking at what in Mexico was the Federal Direction of Security, and its role is usually translated as a political or a secret police. This was a police that was in charge of trying to prevent any kind of social turmoil. They were in charge of spying on politicians from Mexico and from abroad. And after a long time, their files were made public. And this is as they were spying on revolutionary organizations and so on. When they were made prisoners, they were taken to this building, Lecumberri, and now their files are there. And it was very interesting because the process has been changing constantly. I was able to get access to some of these files for the first time. And I say it's very interesting because over the years, the several commissions from the U.S. government, from the House of Representatives, for example, had tried to get access to these files, and they were denied by a number of reasons, sometimes because of the Mexican government not agreeing to giving them away. And as it comes out in my book, also because the CIA in Mexico didn't want the Mexican government to give their own government, the U.S. government, disinformation. But as decades have passed on, there is now a transparency law that sometimes it works very well. I was very lucky when I submitted my request for this information, because a lot of information of these files were given to me as photocopies. And even if they were redacted, there were so many that between one redaction and the other, they were very eloquent. Just sometimes the information would peek out from behind these redactions. So there's also a historical approach here, where I had to go to these files and try to question them and confront them with some of the information and the versions that have been coming out from what is strongly or not related to the JFK murder from the Oswald visit here to Mexico.
So let me ask now about the context. So your book is about conspiracy theories in Mexico. And I'm interested to know if you see differences between Mexico and the neighboring country, obviously the U.S.
Yes, I think, the title of my book is Bad Hombres, and this comes from the former president of the U.S., Donald Trump, who referred on more than one occasion in these terms to Mexicans. So we were the bad hombres, we were drug dealers, rapists. This is his textual declaration. And the main point, as I mentioned, of conspiracy theories and of this kind of ongoing crime legends is that you need this kind of villain, some bad people, usually men, which will be used for a number of social functions. In this case, from the U.S., It has to do with migration. It has to do with elections. It has to do with pushing some agendas and getting some kind of votes. But what is interesting is that this is fractalic in a lot of sense. I will, before addressing again the U.S., what I found very interesting is that in some of the urban legends that I study, they had first spread very strongly through the U.S., one of them 12 years before. It spread from coast to coast, and it was very widely believed. But then 12 years later, the same urban legend about this criminal gang spread in Mexico. But what was interesting was the social interpretation. In the case of the U.S., it was either Mexican or Latin American migrants were in this kind of gang, or African Americans. And in the case of Mexico, it was clearly Central Americans, people that could be from the Mara Salvatrucha, from El Salvador. And it was the same story, but the bad hombres were different. They were displaced like down of the border. And this also happens the other way around. Sometimes in Mexico, there are some fears, social fears about the U.S., because we have a boundary with the country that has the strongest economy, army, and so on. So these bad hombres come in different ways. I think this is the strongest one. At the same time, there's even currently this huge migration. You know, millions of Mexicans live in the U.S., a good number of over a million people from the U.S. live in Mexico. This probably has helped to a certain extent. There are new bad hombres narratives evolving due to this migration, even if it's, you know, it can be white collar, it can be more kind of field work and so on. But I think this will give, in time, place to new urban legends and new bad hombres. But I think that the main difference, again, is that in Mexico, the urban legends are stronger because we live currently a problem of unsafety. No, there's a lot of crime and so on. So these things really spread, and they seem to be a warning, and they seem to help. So I think that mainly Mexico think about its government, that it's corrupt and crumbling. And that's a very strong difference with conspiracy theories in the United States, because over there, it's more this idea of the deep state. Whatever the attribution is there, is that there is like this very organized, very well-oiled, very efficient organization that is pulling all the strings, is making all the scenarios, and it can be attributed to a number of bad hombres in that case. No, it can be reptilians, it can be, you know, wokes and liberals, it can be some kind of anti-Semitic plot and so on. I mean, it would be more like some kind of Jewish organization behind this. So there's an anti-Semitic tone in these kind of things. I think that's a huge difference. The U.S. is afraid of this organization behind the scenes in conspiracy theories, and Mexico, we're more afraid of chaos and corruption.
Now, let's move to 1991. The move by Oliver Stone, JFK. You already mentioned JFK. Now, this movie not only resurrected conspiracy theories about the assassination of the American president, but essentially made Americans and also non-Americans more skeptical in general. The one thing that many may not necessarily know, or know very little, is that actually Lee Harvey Oswald was in Mexico before killing JFK. And I was wondering if you can speak about Oswald's visit, actually the real one, and then later on we're going to talk about the conspiracies.
Okay, yes, it's I find it a great topic. That's why I wrote this book. And I think this is the longest chapter in the book. The thing about Oswald's visit is that, again, it can be a very simple affair. I will start with that. The version, the one that is more facts-based, is that he went for 5 days to Mexico, about 7 weeks before the 22nd of November of 1963, when Kennedy is killed. And he went, it seems in this version, to try to get two visas. One for the USSR, where he previously had lived. His wife, Marina, was from the USSR, and he was not having a good time. He wanted to go back. And as he was going from Mexico, he was also trying to get a transit visa from Cuba to get to the USSR. I will make a small parenthesis here, because the whole importance of Oswald going to Mexico is because the role that Mexico had in the geopolitical order at that moment, which I think it was not very well known. It's made like a comparison to Vienna, the Vienna of the Third Man, this film that shows how like every government had some spies there, and it was similar in Mexico. Mexico was the only country that had both a Russian and a Cuban embassy, being so close to the United States, and it also had strong working relations with the U.S., including the CIA. So Oswald came because, again, to get to Cuba, you mainly could do it only from Mexico. The only flights were in that direction, so that's why he comes here. He tries to get both visas. Both visas are declined. He doesn't get them. This takes some months, but he's not successful. And then we know very well about this, because we have the reports of all the intelligence operations, the spying operations from the CIA and the Mexican government on these communist embassies. So he was followed when he went in, when he went out. But after that, he's another 3.5 days in Mexico, and we know very little about this. There are some references. He said that he went to a bullfight, he went sightseeing, nothing very conspirational. Now, this thing gets very complicated from here. Why? Because if we take it from Oswald and go, first of all, to the CIA on the Russian embassy alone, on the door that Oswald crossed, had 3 different photographic operations trained. And that was just, you know, one of the doors. So it seems that at some point, the CIA tried to get more information and made a phone call. This is likely to have come from counterintelligence. You know, there was somebody who was pretending to be Silvia Tirado or Silvia Duran, who was a Mexican working in the Cuban consulate and was the one who was speaking with Oswald about the visa. And at some point, there was a call on the same week. There were 2 different calls of a man who couldn't speak Russian and a woman that said that she was this Silvia. And then after the 22nd of November, when Kennedy is killed, there is like the Warren Commission, the government start asking for all the CIA material. But the CIA was in a very difficult position because some of these operations the Mexican government knew about. They knew about one photographic operation, but a lot of the other operations, it was not something that the Mexican government had agreed. So this, to a long extent, was both illegal and it would jeopardize the cooperation they had with the Mexican government. So what seems to happen is that after Kennedy's killed, they send a picture of somebody who is not Kennedy, and to this day we don't know who he is in front of one of the embassies, and they send a tape with these voices pretending to be Oswald and Silvia. And this is very strange because then we have this physical Oswald that comes, but we have an impersonation of Oswald. So there is, we can speak of a second Oswald. And what is more strange is that in the first conversation regarding this material that the then chief of the FBI, Edgar J. Hoover, had with the just sworn president, new president Lyndon Johnson, it is Hoover who says there seems to be more than one Oswald down there. And he was referring to this confusion. No, so this is why we can have 2, 3 or more Oswalds. And from here we go to the conspiracy theories. But still, I will keep more or less on this point. I think that it's very important what you mentioned about Oliver Stone's movie, because these conspiracy theories about Oswald's visit to Mexico, they were not like so strong in, say, 1962. I think for a number of reasons. What I say in my book is how after the Second World War, there was like this couple of decades of hope, of trust in the future, of trust in authorities. And some analysts think that this ends with the assassination of Kennedy, when you have the president of the U.S. being killed in a way that is not clearly explained or is not satisfactorily enough explained for a lot of people. Trust on institutions starts going down. But after, in 1962, some of the aspects of the trip start coming out, especially for the between governments. The CIA asks for a number of actions to be done, especially to be Silvia Tirado, to be picked up by the Mexican police and interrogated, and they then recant. And also they ask political police in Mexico to look around and see, go after where Oswald had been. At the same time, they had to try to pretend they were not involved, so they could not get in contact with any Mexicans beyond the political police. And it's more during the late 70s and the late 60s and 70s that other stories start to come out. And these stories start to say, for example, as it will come out, some very intriguing things about Mexico. But at the moment, I will stop here just saying that, okay, the visit was supposed to be short, simple, unsuccessful, but then other stories came out.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Let me bring a couple of questions together. So first of all, I want to ask about the kind of conspiracy theories and the narratives that emerged in the follow-up of the JFK assassination. You already mentioned a few things here and there. Can you also tell us a little bit more about what you call in the book the twist party, and also the main characters like Elena Garro and Silvia Tirado?
Yes, there are mainly two conspiracy theories that I follow. This is because we were saying after JFK and so on, Mexico has come to be one of the preferred settings for people that say that JFK was killed after a conspiracy, where everything was cooked. And it's a very suitable setting. You know, if you take both fiction or nonfiction, Mexico will usually be portrayed in this very shady characterization where anything can go on and so on. So recently, even serious or books that could come from serious people say that if there was a conspiracy, it was cooked in Mexico. And this has to do with two strands mainly. I will briefly mention one, which is down to a journalist that at some point very randomly was having some drinks with a U.S. Consul in Tampico, and he said that he had met Kennedy. And this was like a snowball. It started rolling, and he was questioned by CIA many times. He spoke to many journalists, and he was very, very shady about the whole thing. Sometimes he said he met Oswald, but he couldn't say anything because he still had communist friends that could come and kill him. This journalist has sadly passed away, but it was very clear from some of the research I did that this was all complete lies. He was not in Mexico City when Oswald was in Mexico City. He was already a journalist in Tampico, which we can follow because of the work he made at the time in newspapers over there. So this conspiracy theory should be dead. But if one thing we can know is that it's almost impossible to kill a conspiracy theory. And the other one is even more complex and more resilient. As you mentioned, there are two women that have a very, very strong position towards this story. One I mentioned, which is Silvia Tirado or Silvia Duran, who was a woman who was she was a sympathizer of the communist revolution in Cuba. She had worked in an institute that fosters relations between both countries, and because the Cuban woman who was in charge of being the secretary at the consulate was killed in an accident, it was almost temping. She was 3 months doing that job as a secretary in the Cuban consulate. And because of doing that job and handling the papers of Oswald and giving him, I will say, her telephone number, her whole life after that has turned, as I mentioned, a groundhog of conspiracy theories. Every time she's hounded to tell more, and afterwards, and very strongly related to this twist party, it came to be known that she was the mistress of Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico. And as she had these communist connections, she had something to do with a conspiracy, a wider conspiracy. This had to be because she at the time was married to a man named Horacio Duran, who was a cousin of Elena Garro. Elena Garro is a brilliant writer. She is truly, truly great. her early work, especially a book, a novel, and a couple of book of short stories are great. But there are a lot of analysis of her work and life coming even from feminist scholars. This is important because in the end, the easier way to say this is that she had a very complex personality. Part of this complexity had to do that she had very strong difficulties in sometimes distinguishing fact from fiction. She told this herself. She says that the material of her short stories and novels came from what she understood to be real. And some of these, some people say that she is the true inventor of magic realism. So this gives you an idea that she's not like, she doesn't delve much in realism or naturalism. However, she hated Silvia Tirado, who was this kind of political cousin, and some things started mixing. In the early 60s, 1964, there was a CIA asset called Junkov, who was in Mexico, especially to spy after intellectual organizations, writers' associations, and so on. And at some point, Junkov was staying in Garro's house. And she reported that after the Warren Commission report came out, Garro said that she had gone to a twist party where Oswald was present. And there were some characters, intellectuals from Mexico City, which were sympathetic to the Cuban Revolution, and also some hipsters at the moment. Some beatniks, I think it was the word she used at the moment. Again, this was like a characterization that there were bad hombres in that meeting. This, I mean, trying to see this from a factual point of view is complicated because at the moment, Chubby Checker's twist was a huge success in Mexico. There were twist parties. This couple, Silvia and Horacio Duran, had made a twist party to one they had invited the Garros. But what never happened is that they invited Oswald to this. To this day, the people that Elena Garro said that were in the party have said that this never happened. They laughed when this was brought to it. There was a very good issue of a periodical, a news magazine called Proceso, in 1992 that called them and they said it didn't happen. They even called Garro, and Garro at that moment said that didn't happen, that it was a lie attributed to her. And even to the moment, these two versions, the idea that Oswald was never there, has always been defended by the Durans and the people they knew. They have come to speak even to the HSCI, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, no, that came to Mexico, and they denied this again. And it has always been the Garro family who has kept telling this story. Garro said that she had gone with her daughter and with her sister. And now the three of them, they have also passed. And now her nephew, Francisco Garro, has even told that he was also in the party. This is very strange because they were never there. Francisco was never in that telling of the story that he was there. Even he spoke with Charles Thomas, who was the officer from the U.S. Embassy who spread this rumor. And I call it that it's the Garro family franchise because it's something, a story that they have been peddling for over 50 years now. Everybody else says it's not true. But this story, it's harder to disprove. It cannot be proved, as in the case of Contreras, which is this journalist from Tampico, that you can see his work in the newspaper and say, okay, you were not in Mexico City. Again, because they were in the same place. There is a very strong trail of documents that help to this. At some point, Elena Garro and her daughter called somebody from the embassy who is the representative of the FBI in Mexico, and they have a meeting, and she gives as evidence of the twist party a letter with the name of the man who was there, who sent it to the daughter because he wanted to date her. And the FBI man goes and speaks to this guy and who was an Italian living in Mexico, and he says, okay, I remember the party, they were there, but there was not Oswald, and this happened before Oswald was in Mexico. So the twist party is something that on a real basis, Oswald was never there. but even Mexican serious journalists start still keep believing this. And to this day, it's like the strongest evidence that conspiracy theorists have that Oswald was planning something in Mexico.
That is fascinating, given the fact that he was not there, but nevertheless. I want to move to the urban crime legends that you analyze in your book. And I was wondering if you can give us a summary. You already mentioned them earlier. And also, you talked about earlier how, you know, you see conspiracy theories and urban legends merging together. So I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about how these stories transform from urban legends into conspiracy theories in Mexico. And here I'm really referring to the so-called Lights Out and Burundanga.
Yes. Yes, I'll try to summarize them. Lights Out is very short. I think it will be very familiar to whoever listens to this podcast because it has, I think, been everywhere. And the main idea is that if you are driving, what the wording said is, if you're driving this weekend at night and you see a car without lights, do not flash your lights, you know, as a warning saying, hey, you're going on the dark, because there is a gang initiation ritual. So the gang, the aspiring member is in that car without lights and they will turn around and kill you and everybody in your car. And this is the way they get accepted into the gang. That's the story on Lights Out. And Burundanga, it also has changed. In the US, it was called as the Burundanga business cards. And the main idea is that there's this substance that it's very, very exotic, very dangerous, which is called like this Burundanga. It comes from Colombia, as many drugs have. So it's usually linked to this other story. And it's something that even if you just touch a paper that has been infused with this Burundanga, or even if they just put it close to your nose, you will inhale it and you will become some sort of zombie. You will not remember what you are doing when you are under the influence, and you can go and empty your own ATM, give all the money, do whatever you're told, and you will not remember a thing the next day. So in very shortly, these are the two legends. And the thing again, Lights Out is very clear, because what I had mentioned, how in Mexico, this was supposed to be related to Mara Salvatrucha, which is a gang of Salvadoran immigrants in the US that has connections to El Salvador. And this relates very strongly to urban legends, for example, regarding migration, which is something that is usually latent between a lot of both conspiracy theories and urban legends, crime legends. Because recently, for example, with some of the caravans of Central American migrants that head to the US, they want to get there, but they have to cross the whole Mexico. It was being thought that somebody was sending them. Not that it was like a spontaneous human phenomenon, but that there were some political forces making them to cross. So you see, it's very much the same thing. There's a reaction that I mean, the whole idea of bad hombres is that this is being told by the good people. We are the good people and we have to beware of all those that are bad and try to come here and hurt us. And that come here is very important because it's like against all this kind of a movement of people across boundaries. And the idea behind, again, is, for example, this has to do in the US with this conspiracy theory that says that there's like a huge program trying to replace population. And white population is trying to be replaced with people with other kind of ethnicities and colors of skin. So this is how they clearly have some sort of association. And again, these bad hombres that we see or we don't, they're trying to affect the way we live and our, let's say, the whole way of life, families, homes, everything.
Now, you have done a great work of textual analysis that I mentioned earlier on both stories, so Lights Out and Burundanga. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about this analysis and what your work actually shows about both conspiracy theories.
Yes. Yes, as I mentioned, the main thing is how this, growing, I think, that everywhere in the world is the uncertainty that we experience. This is seen on even on an ecological level, you know, is the world we're living and the way we're living sustainable? What will happen? And what happens if we run out of water? What happens if we run out of energy and so on? And this uncertainty makes us believe more strongly the people we know, this target group that I mentioned, our family, our close colleagues, our friends. So the main thing is that if information is coming from them, we will believe it much more strongly than if it comes from, say, an official source or a specialist. This will be the case in I think, a growing number of people. And the main thing of the paratextual work, it does show how it comes, how we are influenced by a number of cues. How, if it's somebody we know, how if it's there are some credentials that give it authority, even if it's unofficial. In these urban legends, there's a lot of references to people that work in the system but are against the system. For example, a policeman that was received this news about the criminal gangs, I said, okay, my uncle is a policeman and he told me that this will not be officially on any news item, but it's true, it's going on. So, you know, even these sources are taking as more legitimate because they are within, but they are against. And I think all of these cues will continue. There will be making this kind of narratives more pervasive and more persuasive as well.
I must confess that when I drive around Chicago at night, I often bump into cars with no lights. It's common, particularly in newer cars, that we have, you know, you still have the regular lights, but not the full lights. But the thing is that I'm tempted to flash, but I'm not doing. And after reading your book, I really realized that these things stuck with you. It's unbelievable the power of these stories and these narratives, you know, the effect they may have on people. And in fact, I want to ask you about your chapter 6 in the book, where you talk about conspiracy theories as providing a sense of understanding, you know, when the context is too complex and hard to make sense of it, conspiracy theories provide an answer, and also provide an answer, you know, for people that they have to make sense of a lack of agency. And you try to explain how conspiracy theories are as a sort of a provisional remedy for social anxiety. And I was really fascinated by your discussion of one specific point, which you call the magical thought. And I was wondering if you can elaborate more on this idea.
Yes, sure. The main thing is, again, that during the 20th century, there was like this optimism about a number of things, where the world was heading. There wouldn't be a next world war. There was like this human rights start to develop and so on. And there was a strong trust in science for, again, some decades. But then this started turning again. And the main idea is that this idea that was very clear in those years, I think, from probably the 1940s to the end of the 1960s, when it starts changing, was that science would make our lives better. And we would stop believing, for example, in urban legends, conspiracy theories, and so on. This is also on the very first authors that start writing about this. Alpert and Postman, who had one of these rumor clinics during the war, they said that there was an approach that they would soon be eradicated. And it has been completely the opposite. So I think that in these years, we have had to come back to the idea that we still have and hold a lot of the worldview that comes from the evolution of our species. And we are still very strongly drawn by some things that are completely magical. The example that I put, there was a study someplace that said that still a good number of scientists will knock on wood, for example. So there's like a paradox. If they're scientists, why do they knock on wood? And this is something that it's called cheap insurance. If there's something that seems to be really terrible, for example, if you're thinking of a family member who is out and you start worrying, you will knock on wood because it costs you nothing. It's a cheap way of insurance because, say, this way we will avert evil. It will not happen to us. And I think that especially with the circulation of the urban legends, this happened. You know, it's something that arrives to your inbox. It is a legend, and even in that sense, folklorists would say that legends are the same from the beginning. No, when they started grouping, when they were only transmitted orally, to this day, where they call it them contemporary legends, they're urban because mostly they had to do with cities and so on. But there's like this, it's almost like casting a spell of protection. I get this legend, I read it, and I send it to everybody I care in order to protect them as well. You know, it's like this good spell to protect them. And what you mentioned of agency is very, very important because, again, we have been told for centuries now that our fate is in our hands. We are the ones who will build it. But this uncertainty is saying the opposite thing. So in a way, urban legends give us very detailed information. It's very simple, which is important. They condense all this uncertainty, all these possible risks on these bad hombres. And they say, okay, they are operating in this way. They are flashing their lights, so they are going without lights. So if you stop from blinking your lights, you will be safe, which is what you said you had unconsciously adopted as a safekeeping attitude. No? So I think that happens a lot. This will keep going on. And it also works in the case of strengthening, making stronger these alliances, you know, with people that you send these legends. It's also a way of showing that you care about them. And on the side of conspiracy theories, I think this is also very clear on the simplistic point. I mean, there's a lot of things on conspiracy theories that try to make things that are very complex as binary as possible. Bad hombres is part of the thing. Good people would be the other. And again, it's almost like this binary thing, very manichaeist, between us, the good people, and them, the bad ones. And it's also a magical thing saying, okay, we're on the good side and the evil people is on the other side. No, it's almost like this white and black distinction between good and evil.
It was just fascinating for me, probably because growing up in Italy, I share some of these kind of a cultural heritage, and I never really thought about the magical character of it and also how this could play into conspiracy theory. Now, let me move to your last chapter. The last chapter of your book is an attempt to shift the focus from the micro to the macro. And I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about, you know, what do you think the conspiracy theories you have discussed tell us about Mexico, its politics and society, and possibly also about the future of Mexico?
Yeah, I think that this is sadly very fertile ground. Because now, as in many places, as the US and so on, I think that they have become part of a political weaponry. You know, it's something that will be instrumentally used to try to strive things, opinions, and so on, one way or another. This is happening very presently. Our president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has always had some of these features. This week, he tweeted, as being true, a picture that came from the internet, and it says it was some kind of forest elf, what we call aluches, from the Mayan people in the southern part of the country. But he treated it as a fact. So again, we're going to the same thing where it's more, there are some other psychologists have seen that people that are more superstitious tend to believe more in conspiracy theories. And since many years ago, decades ago, when he was mayor of Mexico City, he had many of these things going on. He even when he was in office, a comic was published that was saying AMLO, which is his acronym, against dark forces. So if you see, even in those dark forces, the bad hombres are present. It was him against this conspiring thing. And in his discourse, it's completely a binary thing. He's very much of the idea and has said it many ways, not that in a democracy there can be very diverse point of view, but that people have to be with him or against him. And he, as a good populist, he speaks about the people. And the enemies, the bad hombres here, are the conservatives, which are always plotting. They are having these whole things trying to undermine his government and his actions and so on. So this is what we're living every day. And again, part of his own tools, which are very effective, is holding a 2 or 3 hour press conference in the mornings. And these terms are always there. Every single day they come and are part of the political discourse. So I think that it's very difficult, but trust is very undermined. I don't see trust going up. And with these, some of these narratives, especially those persuasive, those that are able to swear people, will be more and more important. So in this sense, I think this is very important to keep studying conspiracy theories, because it will be what we eat and hear and listen pretty much every day.
Can you draw some conclusion in relation to your work of analysis? And I was wondering if you can also add comments, given the fact that your book essentially was produced across the pandemic. So is there anything that you think has changed in the meantime? And if so, which directions these conspiracy theories have taken?
Yes, I think that, I mean, as coming from what I was saying before, I think that what this optimist view that conspiracy theories would, you know, wane and die is completely out of the question. I think that also it's very, very common that some of these topics are analyzed, and I think it's very useful, with biological metaphors. It's something that also comes on the book. Urban legends especially were sometimes studied as memes, as Richard Dawkins first put it, how these were like some kind of cultural genes that just spread and become viral, which is another metaphor. So I think that this is really what is going to be the pathological view, that we would be vaccinated against this kind of misinformation, is not going to happen. And it's more something that we will have to live with them, pretty much as viruses. Again, this analogy brings us to the pandemic. And it was very interesting to see from that prism what was going on, and to understand my own book, because I was finishing when the pandemic was starting, and some of these things were completely there. Everybody was accusing each other of having cooked the virus on purpose, or having let it slip accidentally from a lab. But you know, this was from a Republican congressman, Tom Cotton, I think, who was first, that it came from a Wuhan lab. But then Biden came in office, coming from the Democrat Party, and he instructed the intelligence agencies to check if this story was true. So again, we have like this rehashing of the same story from very different parties, and it's not going to go. It's still going to be there. And also, there was a lot of blaming. You know, the U.S. blamed China. China blamed the U.S. that in the Winter Military Olympics, I think they had brought it there. Putin, there was. It's interesting because in Mexico, there was a very viral video of Vladimir Putin saying something, obviously in Russian, and the captions were in Spanish, and he was saying that this was like some experiment to try again to wipe some populations. So again, it was a plot by bad hombres from some other part of the country. So it if anything, it has very, very interesting to try to see some of the things that I was saying in the book confirmed. And also there's an interesting thing of how this messages change from the platform they're being communicated. So a lot of this also circulated in WhatsApp. The only problem is that WhatsApp is not so eloquent for this kind of paratextual work. I mean, I think even email is still something that new generations use less, but I think usually academics, we complain we have too many emails to answer. I don't think they will go. But the technological transition will also be interesting. I think that there will be a change probably to more, going back to more oral or even audiovisual messages, but through technology. I think this is something that will come. And in this sense, I think that it will be very important to also try to focus on not necessarily trying to disprove the legends, because as we have said, sometimes this is impossible, but try to understand what are the anxieties in the people that are circulating these stories. And this might help us to understand better a number of things, and also to address better this misinformation.
This was Gonzalo Soltero, author of Conspiracy Narratives South of the Border, Bad Hombres Do the Twist, published by Routledge in 2021. Gonzalo, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Roberto. It has been a pleasure being here.